On Monday, April 5th, 1909, in the Phoenix Gazette, an incredible story, an article that would blow your mind. In a moment, we're going to be talking with David Hatcher Childress about this and some other stories. He is a well-known author, of course, The Mystery of the Olmecs, Technology of the Gods, Lost Cities of North and Central America. What a story we have in store for you next on Coast to Coast AM. David Hatcher Childress, known as the real-life Indiana Jones to many of his fans, he has traveled the world several times over seeking adventure and the answers to the mysteries of mankind's past. In 1976, David left the United States on what would become a six-year research and adventure odyssey. During the time, he first studied firsthand the ancient civilizations of Africa, the Middle East, China, sometimes journeying into very dangerous territory along the way. And David, of course, has a wide scope of interest, as you will find out tonight, not only on ancient civilizations and technology, but also free energy, anti-gravity, and UFOs. And he's been just investigating these subjects for well over 20 years. David Hatcher Childress. Hey, David, welcome back. How are you?
Hi. Good, George. It's good to be back on your show.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
You know, it's been a few years, and in that time, well, I've been traveling around the world and working on new books.
Getting new data for us.
yes, indeed. And, you know, this whole thing of the Egyptian city and the Grand Canyon is one of those popular subjects that just, you know, won't go away. And it's an interesting one to discuss. It will actually be a chapter, too, in an upcoming book that I'm working on that should be out next spring, which is a book called Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest.
Excellent. Because you, in your book, The Lost Cities of North and Central America, also, you made reference to the Phoenix Gazette article. Let's talk about that for a moment. It came out in 1909. What was that?
You know that it was a front page newspaper story in the 1909 Phoenix Gazette. Phoenix was a young city then. And what they reported was really astonishing. I mean, they reported that the Smithsonian Institution was doing excavations in the Grand Canyon. They said that it was being supervised by an archaeologist named Jordan. It all had to do with another explorer named Kincaid, who had been traveling down the Grand Canyon. And what he claimed he discovered was these caverns inside the Grand Canyon. Inside these caverns were, he thought, and then the Egyptian, the Smithsonian, then later confirmed, according to the newspaper report, that there were Egyptian artifacts, there were Hindu, Buddhist artifacts from India. They were saying that, you know, there were mummies in there. They were saying this was going to totally change the history of America and the Southwest. Egyptians and Hindus and Buddhists were coming across the Pacific and the Atlantic, coming to North America. They were involved in the civilizations here, and that apparently they had a special vault in the Grand Canyon where they buried some of the leaders, the people they had left behind with artifacts and things like that, and that the Smithsonian Institution got involved. They were hauling all this stuff out of these caves, including these mummies, swords, shields, statues.
Jeez.
Right. And then this the Jordan, the archaeologist, he was going back to Washington, D.C., back to the Smithsonian. And, I mean, this is these exciting new discoveries in the Grand Canyon. There was one follow-up story, and then no one really ever heard of it again. And it's really a lot like the first Indiana Jones movie, where Indiana Jones has discovered the Lost Ark of the Covenant, and then he, right at the end of the movie, he says, well, you know, where's the Ark? And they tell him, oh, well, don't worry, you know, top men are working on it. And then the last scene in the movie is this giant warehouse, apparently at the Smithsonian, and the Ark of the Covenant is in this crate, and it's being put in this giant warehouse, and no one's ever going to see it again.
Just put away, yeah.
And that's kind of what appears to have happened with these artifacts in the Grand Canyon. So,
well, first of all, do you think the article was real? It wasn't a joke, wasn't a hoax, right?
Well, you know, back in those days, there were a lot of hoax newspaper articles. And, you know, as a researcher, I'm constantly looking for and digging up old newspaper articles and stories about giants, unusual archaeological finds, weird things like that. And when you look at this one, especially because of the detail, it's naming people. Later, I was able to verify some of it, and I would say yes. I mean, this does seem to be a true story. And the more and more I've looked into it over the years, I first wrote about it in my book, Lost Cities of North and Central America, and that came out in 1994. And in those years, I've had a number of letters. People have called me occasionally, trying to give me, you know, different leads and things like that. And in the end, what I've concluded is that, yes, there really is something to this.
Did anybody ever find this Kincaid fellow who was the explorer?
You know, this was all turn of the century. The article is in 1909. He was doing this in, say, 1906 that he went down. I mean, it all took, like, years and stuff for these things to come out. Yeah, no one ever really discovered this Kincaid fellow. And, in fact, Jordan, the archaeologist, he seems to have vanished, too. Although, as we've gone through old records of the Smithsonian, there is a guy who's mentioned named Jordan a few times. It's likely that he disappeared, too.
It's weird.
Well, it's quite a strange thing. And then as I started looking into the Smithsonian and the idea of cover-ups, people naturally ask me when this subject comes up, they're like, well, why would they cover something like that up anyway? And that is a good question, and you know, there are answers for that. Part of the whole thing of the Southwest and what was going on here, even right now, I'm in Arizona talking to you. There's a lot of the history here is just so discombobulated. The idea of mummies that were found in the Grand Canyon. Mainstream archaeologists maintain even today that Native Americans here in New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, Utah, whatnot, that they didn't mummify the dead. And yet the Grand Canyon article is talking about mummies and things like that in these caverns. So that itself was a clue. Are there mummies out here? And one of the things that I found out that was pretty strange, too, is that the quintessential roadside attraction out in the desert, it's in southern Arizona near Tombstone, near Benson, and it's called The Thing. And as you're driving through the desert, you start seeing the billboards, 100 miles to The Thing. What is The Thing? Next exit, The Thing. And so eventually you get your parents to pull off and take you to The Thing at this gas station. And I've been to The Thing a couple of times. And
what is
you can
thing?
Still see it, actually.
What is it?
What is it? Yeah, when you go through, you pay a dollar, and you get to go in and see The Thing. And what The Thing is a mummy of a woman and child together. And they're mummified. And supposedly, this mother and child mummy, that is, they call The Thing, is from the Grand Canyon. And trying to trace it, The Thing, is very tricky. What little information I've gotten is that it was purchased privately, also around 1910 or so. It came out of Flagstaff, Arizona, which is near to the Grand Canyon. And apparently, The Thing may well be one of the artifacts, one of the mummies that came out of these caves, rock cut caves in the Grand Canyon.
There were also apparently tablets of stone with hieroglyphs written all over it that the Smithsonian folks took.
That's right, and we don't know what hieroglyphs that would have been, Egyptian, presumably. They don't describe them. There's no photos. We don't That's one of the things that I've really searched for. Old photos, photos of these objects. I mean, I've found the thing. There was an interesting story of a guy who, his name was Seth Tanner. And Seth Tanner was a Mormon guy who came down from Utah in the late 1800s. He had to flee Utah, essentially. He was a wanted man. He had been part of this famous Mormon massacre in Utah. As federal troops went into Utah, he fled into the Grand Canyon, as did a number of Mormon pioneers who the law was after. And what a lot of these guys did was they went into the Grand Canyon, particularly the northern area, and they prospected. They created, one guy created a ferry, Lee's Ferry. They went up many old trails and things like that. And this guy, Seth Tanner, in fact, a lot of things in the Grand Canyon are named after this guy. There's a Tanner Trail. There's Tanner Wash. There's a Tanner Canyon, particularly up in northern Arizona and around the Navajo Indian Reservation, which does include part of the Grand Canyon. This guy is really famous. And a weird thing happened to him. I was able to find a photograph of him from the late 1800s. He, according to the stories, and it's hard to find information, but I've been poring over old books on the Grand Canyon. This guy did a lot of prospecting in really remote areas of the Grand Canyon, and the area that I identified a lot where these things were going on was where the Little Colorado meets the Grand Canyon, and that is its own canyon in itself, the Little Colorado Canyon. This guy, Seth Tanner, at some point, he went into some kind of a cave, and the Hopi Indians caught him there, and he was in some sacred place, some forbidden secret spot that no one was allowed to see, but he saw it. Now, normally they would have killed him, except he had several wives, and one of his wives was a Hopi Indian. So instead of killing him, they blinded him, and they threw some kind of a acid or something in his face, and he became blind. And that was, for them, that was good enough. And he spent the rest of his life as a blind old man in various villages around the Grand Canyon. Children and other people would have to lead him around and feed him. And there were some photos taken of him. And you can see him. He's got his eyes open. He clearly is blind. And he's a bushy old prospector guy. His name was Seth Tanner. And from what I can tell, what happened was he, and this was before the 1909 article in the Phoenix Gazette. Yeah. He had stumbled into these secret caves in the Grand Canyon and would have been killed, except he was blinded. I've also found that there's a couple of movies that are basically also based on this story. One is the great Gregory Peck Western called McKenna's Gold. And that movie, and in my mind, that's a great Western. That movie, too, is about this secret city in the Grand Canyon. There's mining is involved. One of the things that's in this area, too, is a special Hopi salt mine. That mine is off limits today, and certain Hopi elders are allowed to go down into the Grand Canyon to this salt mine. But other visitors are not allowed into that area. And in my mind, this seems to be around the area where Seth Tanner was doing his prospecting, where he found some cave, where he was blinded. And it seems to be also the place that the 1909 Phoenix Gazette article was talking about.
You know, Hopi legend also talks about ancestors to the Hopis once living in an underground world in the Grand Canyon. And that could also explain some of this stuff.
Well, that's right. I mean, as you start to look into this whole thing, there's an Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. It also has to do, apparently, with Hindus and Buddhists coming from ancient India and stuff like that. And if the Hopi Indians are absolutely part of it, their own legends of their own origin, like as you're saying, is that they lived underground in the Grand Canyon with the ant people. And this was during, the Hopis also have the same kind of mythology as the Aztecs and the Mayans, and the Olmecs had this too, where the world has been destroyed many times in the past, four or five times, and we're living in either the fourth or the fifth world, depending on the Aztec or Mayan, and the Hopis have that too. So during these periodic destructions and cataclysms, the Hopi at one point went underground, lived in deep beneath the earth, in the Grand Canyon somewhere, and they lived with these ant people, they said, and then they emerged, you know, after the cataclysms were over and the new world was born. They emerged from a hole in the Grand Canyon, a place called the Sipapu. And that's a place in the Grand Canyon you can also, you can find some photographs of it. It's near to the Hopi salt mines. It's near to where all these things are named after this Tanner guy. And, it is like a hole in the ground. You're not allowed to go there either. And this is something else you'll find, as I did. We started researching this. There's a lot of places in the Grand Canyon that are off limits.
Legally
controlled.
Okay.
Gets a lot of visitors too every year. But you know, if you want to go hiking the Grand Canyon and go places, you have to apply in advance. There's a number of areas that are utterly off limits. And weird secret places. There's another strange thing about the Grand Canyon. If you look at a map of the Grand Canyon and all of the many different formations, they've given them names. But they've given them these Egyptian and Hindu and Buddhist names.
Isn't
things
that
like
incredible?
Shiva Temple, Temple of Cheops, Osiris Temple, Buddha Temple, things like that. So that was kind of strange right there, too, that for some unknown reason, perhaps just coincidence, so much stuff in the Grand Canyon has all these Egyptian and Hindu Buddhist.
Who gave them those names, David?
Well, again, early prospectors and things like that. And, you know, some of the formations in the Grand Canyon, like the Cheops Pyramid, they look like, you know, pyramids from a distance. So they're given those names. But there's just such a plethora of these names all through the Grand Canyon and linked to that. You know, a curious thing, too, with so many of the Indian tribes around here, the Hopis, the Zunis, you have the different Pueblo Indians. The Zunis are who live also near the Grand Canyon, but they live near Gallup, right along the Arizona-New Mexico border, although part of the Zuni reservation is in Arizona. But some years ago, University of Oregon anthropologist wrote a book about the Zunis. And in her studies, she found that the Zunis were speaking ancient Japanese. How about that?
Jeez.
And in fact, if you go to Zuni, I was just there recently, and she talks about this in her book, the Zuni names are very kind of standard kind of Japanese names, like the ones we think of today, like Hayakawa and things like that, Kawasaki. These are normal Zuni names. Zunis have also been sent to Japan and are sort of easily able to learn Japanese kind of thing. So you have a whole idea that the area around the Grand Canyon, around the Four Corners area, Flagstaff, also around Phoenix, all that area was much more developed 1,500 years ago. In fact, all around Phoenix, Phoenix is an aptly named city. There are ancient concrete canals that intersect all around Phoenix. And the modern city of Phoenix is still using these canals today. The Hohokam Indians who lived around Phoenix and Casa Grande, they irrigated the whole desert. They built three-story concrete buildings like Casa Grande.
Let's find out if the Egyptians did come here, David, when we come back. How did they migrate here? We'll be back. We're with a great adventurer, David Hatcher Childress. David, if Egyptians migrated here to the North Americas, when might they have done it, and how do you think they got here?
Well, you know, probably the Egyptians came to the North America at least by about 1000 BC. That would be 3,000 years or so ago, they would naturally have come by boats. I mean, it's one of the enigmas of, say, the ancient Egyptians. You go to ancient Egypt, you see all this great dynastic architecture. They build these huge temples, pyramids, other buildings out of giant blocks of granite and basalt and limestone. But supposedly, though great architects and having, you know, quite an advanced science, the Egyptians didn't go anywhere. They did have large boats, but they didn't use them, supposedly. They were a very sort of insulated civilization, allegedly, who just stayed in their own country and, you know, maybe made a few little exploratory adventures and things like that. That is basically your isolationist point of view. Most universities are teaching that, especially in the United States. That's the idea that civilizations are isolated from each other. They don't have much contact. Crossing oceans is very difficult. You can't just get in a boat, cross an ocean, and go somewhere. You have to walk places, allegedly. The flip side of that is diffusionism. It is, I'm more of a champion of that, for sure. Mm-hmm. Thor Heyerdahl, the famous Norwegian archaeologist, who I met several times and was something of a hero of mine, he passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Kon-Tiki fame?
Exactly. And he would build these balsa rafts, and he would build reed boats and things like that, and then he would sail them across the Atlantic or Pacific as far as he could, trying to prove that ancient people also got into boats. I mean, the whole idea that oceans are barriers, for Native Americans to get down to Central America or South America, they can't get in a boat and go there. They have to, like, walk for thousands of miles through hostile tribes. It would take them generations, where, in fact, being in a boat would be much faster, safer, easier to go places. And in fact, oceans are highways, not barriers. Getting into a boat and going someplace, that's an easy way to go places. Ancient Egypt was an unusual country, like ancient Israel. You had countries that had the ability to have a port on the Mediterranean, which the Egyptians did and the ancient Hebrews, and you could have a port city on the Red Sea. And that would allow you to go out into the Indian Ocean. You could go down through East Africa. You could cross the Arabian Sea. You could go to Muscat. You could go to Persia, to India, to Sri Lanka, on to Australia, and of course, to Pacific Islands and to South America. Now, I mean, it's kind of interesting how archaeologists think, particularly the isolationists. One of the stories in the Bible is of King Solomon's mines and a trip to Ophir. And Ophir was a three-year journey. And it's talked about in the Old Testament in Kings. They would leave from Elot on the Red Sea, and they would go for one entire year out somewhere past India and Indonesia. There they would get exotic feathers, they would bring apes back, and they would bring back all this gold. And it was this gold that they brought back that built the first temple in Jerusalem. Now here's the thing. You have the Bible saying, yeah, it's a three-year trip. Right. 1 year to go there. 1 year. They would stay there 1 year, and then it would be 1 year back. Well, archaeologists were looking for Ophir and King Solomon's mines, and where they think they are, they found a gold mine in Saudi Arabia. So they thought, oh, well, this has to be King Solomon's mines. This is Ophir. And others would say, oh, well, they went to Somalia or some area like that in East Africa. Well, there's a problem with that, and that is that, I mean, those places are only a few days' sail from a lot in the Red Sea. I mean, they're not even several weeks of voyaging in actuality. In a year, the ancient Phoenicians and Hebrews who were going on these journeys to Ophir, I mean, they could easily have gone as far as Australia, for instance.
Sure.
And even, as I say in my book on Mystery of the Olmecs and also my other books on lost cities of ancient Lemuria in the Pacific, that they were the ancient Egyptians, the Chinese, many other ancient civilizations. They were going out into the ocean. They were going out into the Pacific. This is one of the solutions, too, to many of the pyramids and megaliths on remote Pacific islands. Tonga, there's this giant city built out of basalt crystals in Micronesia, a city called Nan Madol. That city is like the eighth wonder of the world. The majority of it is actually built into the ocean. Archaeologists estimate there's 150 million tons of basalt that's stacked up into artificial islands and walls and buildings on Ponape in Micronesia. And this incredible city, I mean, it's actually built into the ocean. It's not even on the island. They don't know who built this. I mean, archaeologists are saying, okay, these kind of like Easter Island, where you have a remote island, it has giant megalithic remains on it. But mainstream archaeologists, their explanation is, well, you know, these islanders just kind of got to this Polynesians to some remote island, and they were bored, and they had nothing else to do, and so they built these giant statues. They built this huge city.
Well, all right, in this particular case with the Egyptians ending up in the Grand Canyon, where would they have set sail from Egypt? Where do they land, and why walk or travel all the way to the Grand Canyon from there?
Well, you know, I mean, and that's interesting, too. They may not have had to have walked all that way. I mean, today, all this area around here, Yuma, Palm Springs, very much the inland areas of Southern California and western Arizona. I mean, it is trackless desert. There's no rivers around there at all, except for the Colorado River coming out of the Grand Canyon. In ancient times, and in my book on lost cities of North and Central America, I actually have maps and stuff in there of this. The whole West was much different in ancient times, and California especially. If you look at a good relief map of California, you can see instantly what it was like even just a few thousand years ago, and that is that Central California was a huge inland sea. And all around Fresno and that area, I mean, that's what they call the Central Valley. I mean, if ocean levels or California had just, you know, had been shifted a little bit, that whole area would be flooded, not only from the Golden Gate area, but also up from the south, the Salton Sea, areas like that. And, in fact, there were Finger Lakes already going up into Nevada. I did a show for the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel, and it was all about giants and the legends and lore of giants. They flew me to Reno, where we went to Lovelock, Nevada, which is right near where they do the Burning Man festival now every summer.
Right.
But what is in Lovelock is fascinating, because in Lovelock is a state park known as the Lovelock Caves. And in those caves, what happened was these ranchers began excavating this cave at the turn of the century, and they were looking for bat guano. And there was just tons of bat guano inside these caves. And as they started digging out the caves, they started finding artifacts. Now, the Paiute legends of that area had talked about these red-haired giants coming by boat up around Lovelock. You couldn't do that today. Try and go by boat from the ocean to Lovelock. I mean, it's 1,000 miles of desert.
Can't do it, yeah.
That's right. So their legend was that these giants, red-haired giants, came in boats. Even that area around Lovelock is still some lakes that are drying up today. And, I mean, there's just some marshes there that are the remains of these ancient lakes. And archaeologists and geologists say, yeah, there were lakes there, although, I mean, it's a problem with geology. Geologists think everything's millions of years ago, when, in fact, these lakes couldn't have been that long ago because the Paiute Indians still had legends and stuff of it. I mean, it was only some hundreds of years ago, maybe 1,000 or something like that. Well, so the Indians have these legends of the red-haired giants. When these ranchers began digging out the bat guano in the Lovelock Cave, they started finding duck decoys, baskets, all kinds of hunting and fishing tools for a lake, a large lake. And then, incredibly, they found a number of skeletons. And these skeletons were like 7 foot tall people. They had long red hair. They dragged a dozen of these skeletons out of the cave. This all was around the turn of the century. Get this, George. There are two museums in Nevada today, one in Lovelock, one in Winnemucca. Those museums are wholly dedicated to the finds that were found in Lovelock Cave. The excavations were done by the University of California at Berkeley, actually did the excavations. They know that these things came out of these caves. People at the museum talked about a photo of a rancher standing on a crate holding one of these giants by the hair. And I mean, this thing is huge. And, you know, 7 feet tall, that is a large person with red hair.
Right. And at that time, that was really a giant.
And here's the thing. That photo of that giant, every single one of these giant skeletons is utterly missing. No one knows not only where the skeletons are, they don't even know where photos of them are. Okay? And there's two museums in Nevada that are all about these discoveries. So here you have a double enigma and then a triple one where there's apparently some kind of cover-up and these rather unusual items have just vanished. But you have these giants. They had red hair. They sound like Vikings or something like that, actually. And on top of that, they apparently were going by boat up into, you know, the Black Rock Desert of Nevada. How about that? So as I chronicled all that, apparently California has been drying up for several thousand years. These lakes have been drying up. There was used to be, in the 1800s, there was a big lake around Fresno called Tulare Lake. That lake is not there today. But there used to be big sailing ships and stuff like that on that lake in the like mid-1800s.
Sounds like we're going the way of Mars, David.
Well, I mean, that is what is happening to this planet and places like Chad. Lake Chad, they've been saying now, which is in the kind of southern Sahara. That lake has been drying up now for the last 50 years. It's only about a quarter of what it used to be.
Jeez.
And, you know, it's fine that people should be concerned about the planet drying up and certain lakes going, but throughout history, this is what's been going on. And in California and this area, yeah, there used to be all these lakes, the Salton Sea. In my book on Lost Cities of North and Central America, I have a couple of chapters where I talk about weird ships out in the desert. And these are mainly around Southern California, some of them as Spanish.
Right in the middle of the desert,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, ships out in the desert, that's right. And there's a number of stories along those lines. They know that some of these occurred. A similar thing like this was there was another lake also around Baker, California, and along the Death Valley is very much like this. But there, back in the late 1800s, this lake still existed, and it was a long lake, and they still ran a paddle steamer on it. And one winter, this paddle steamer was taking a load of gold from some mines in Nevada. It sank in a storm on the lake and was gone. That lake then dried up over the next 40 years. And then in the 1930s, one of the early California aviators went out flying over the Southern California desert, and lo and behold, he sees like a riverboat steamer with a paddle wheel out in the desert, covered with, you know, partially covered with sand. And that's how they discovered that ship, and it had a lost gold. This was like, you know, 1928 or something.
That is, all right, so let's assume they were able to boat their way up. Why keep it a secret, David, if the Smithsonian confiscated all these artifacts, mummies and tablets and things like that. Why keep it a secret?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. Part of it is, and it's same reason why a lot of things today would be kept a secret. They're engineering history, and today history is politically correct. It's not necessarily what really happened in the past. It's more like what they want to have happened, or how politically correct they want, say, you know, certain natives to be, or something like that. Another problem, particularly out west, was the Mormons. And of all the states in the United States, you've got the universities basically teaching isolationism. That is, certainly Egyptians didn't come to North America or South America. They didn't travel. Chinese people didn't get in boats and go places. All the Native Americans walked from Siberia down through Canada, down to South America. But in Utah, they don't teach that. And the Mormon religion, which is, you know, pretty interesting in itself. I'm not a Mormon, but I grew up in Colorado, so I've spent a lot of time around Utah and Mormons, and I'm quite familiar with their history. They claim that, yeah, the Egyptians and lost tribes of Israel, that they escaped from the Middle East. They got into boats. They crossed the Mediterranean. They crossed the Atlantic. They landed in Mexico. These were the Nephites and the Jaredites. They then fought all these battles. I mean, you can add to that, as far as I'm concerned, Chinese coming here, Egyptians, Polynesians. You've got Basque sailors and even African kingdoms and stuff like that. But so here is a problem with, say, the Smithsonian and mainstream history, is that suddenly a find like this, that the Egyptians would say were in the Grand Canyon, say that Romans came to Arizona. I go into this in my book as well. That is basically major ammunition for the Mormons. I mean, this is what they've been saying. They're saying, yeah, this is what the Book of Mormon says. Mm-hmm. It says people crossed the ocean. It says Romans came here and Jews came here and stuff. And, you know, see, Book of Mormon must be right. And so the Smithsonian and other powers that be, they're not wanting to give credence to the Book of Mormon, which these finds, you know, would kind of do. And, you know, as an archaeologist, I read all kinds of archaeology books and history books, total fringe, you know, far out books, so similar to the ones I write, and mainstream of all kinds, and the skeptical books, I read them all. And the Mormon archaeology books are quite interesting. And so these are sort of reasons why they want to have cover-ups. A similar thing happened in Brazil, let me tell you, just to show you how these things become politically correct or incorrect. Back in the 70s, the Brazilian Navy went out and they discovered there was a Roman shipwreck off of Rio de Janeiro. And it was underwater. The Navy went down diving on it. They found actually several boats. They started bringing up Roman amphora and Roman coins and stuff like that. America's most famous underwater archaeologist, a guy named Robert Marks.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, David, when we come back. Then we'll also get into the Olmecs. Who were the Olmecs? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, David Hatcher Childress. David, did you want to finish your last thoughts before we move into the Olmecs at all?
Well, yeah. We were talking about how the Brazilian Navy had discovered these Roman shipwrecks off of Rio de Janeiro. But what happened in the end there with this exciting archaeological discovery was it became politicized, and that suddenly the Italian community in Brazil were saying, oh, well, hey, Romans discovered Brazil, in fact, you know, and in fact they should all get, you know, citizenship or whatever. And so what happened was the Brazilian government ordered the Navy to go out there, and they buried these Roman shipwrecks rather than excavate them. So that's how kind of things become politicized. You know, I thought it was interesting, Ulta, your commercial about gold, and we were talking about how the Egyptians and King Solomon and these guys, they went around the world looking for gold. Gold is indestructible. all the gold of ancient times still exists today. To the ancient peoples, including the Egyptians and the Olmecs, the ancient Israelis, it was gold. It was what really mattered to them. They were also searching for jade was very valuable to them, exotic feathers.
If Zechariah Sitchin's right, the Anunnaki came here for gold as well.
That's right. That is part of his whole cosmology, that the Anunnaki came to our planet. They're looking for gold. Ancient peoples have always sought after gold. And in fact, in Peru, and this is one of the ideas, too, that the ancient land of Ophir that the Egyptians and the King Solomon and the Phoenicians were going to was Peru. And in Peru, gold was so plentiful there in ancient times and right up to the times of the Spanish conquest that the Peruvians actually used gold as a, like, wallpaper. And the big temples and things like that in Cuzco were lined with beaten gold. They had gold goblets and plates and everything like that. It was for the Spanish, you know, they went there and said, hey, just give us all of your, you know, dish pans and stuff like that. Well, and they just took them. And the Incas said, yeah, sure, have them, you know, and it was gold. But you see, it's kind of interesting. If in ancient times the King Solomon's navy and whatnot had traveled through the Red Sea, out through the Indian Ocean, and this is what the Bible says they did, just how far they went is the question, but they could have easily have gone out then right between New Guinea and Australia, out into the Pacific. Next stops would have been Fiji and Tonga. From there, you would hit to Tahiti and the Marquesas, and then you would land in Peru. And if you got to Peru, man, you could easily fill up your ship with gold, which is what the Bible says they did, and then head on home. It was a three-year journey. So this is kind of what they were looking for. This is what the Egyptians were looking for in the Southwest. They were exploring. The Chinese, too, were doing similar things. And, in fact, there's been a number of pretty interesting books written just in the last few years about the Chinese circumnavigating the globe before Columbus, a lot of early voyages and things like that. And it's back to what I said earlier, how oceans are highways, not barriers. I mean, it's really unscientific for mainstream archaeologists to insist that ancient people couldn't get into boats and cross oceans. A couple years ago, a French guy swam across the Atlantic Ocean. How about that? I mean, people have crossed the Atlantic in kayaks, small rowboats. Young teenagers have circumnavigated the entire world by themselves in small yachts without GPS or any of that stuff. So, I mean, and that's part of the enigma, too, was that the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Chinese, the Phoenicians, Romans, they had huge ships, gigantic ships that held 300 or 400 people. In Tonga, they had giant ships like that, too, that were going. I mean, they were much bigger than any ships that Columbus had. You now get into things like the Piri Reis map and the maps of the ancient sea kings by Charles Hapgood.
Oh, yeah, that map is incredible.
Well, right, and it seems that even like Columbus and other people, they had some of these old maps, and they were kept secret, too. This was one of the things about a lot of the ancient sea routes and things like that. They were kept secret. The Phoenicians kept secrets. The Phoenician sailors were not allowed to talk about where they went and the ports that they went to. There's a certain a theory, that, and I also go for this, that the Toltecs, whose capital was Tula in northern Mexico, they're related to a lot of the stuff here in Arizona. They conquered Chichen Itza in the Yucatan at one point. The Toltecs are depicted as guys with thick beards and mustaches. They wear helmets. They carry swords and shields. They look like Phoenicians. They look like Mediterranean warriors and stuff.
Persians, everything like that.
Stuff like that, right.
Yeah,
and in fact, it seems that probably the Toltecs were some offshoot of the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, who had already a transatlantic trade. Another similar thing there is the Phoenicians were known as the purple people, and they wore purple robes. And even the whole concept today of kings and queens wearing purple gowns and purple crowns and things like that, that comes from the Phoenicians, who all wore purple. And that purple color was a very special dye that they got from a shellfish. And that was a secret technique of taking this dye. Phoenicians were famous for it, and the Carthaginians were, they were also Phoenicians. But also the Mayans used also this purple dye, this same unusual shellfish dye, which the Phoenicians had a secret. Another curious thing along this line with the Egyptians and stuff is boomerangs. We often think of boomerangs as being some kind of Australian aboriginal
device.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But boomerangs have been found all over the world. And, in fact, the Egyptians hunted with boomerangs. King Tut, in his tomb in Egypt, there was a trunk full of boomerangs that was found in his tomb. It's part of the Tutankhamun treasure. And, in fact, it's if you go to the Cairo Museum and you go to the Tutankhamun area, you will see on display all of his boomerangs. And he was a boomerang nut. I mean, he didn't just have a couple of boomerangs. He had a whole trunk full of dozens of them. It's well known that the Egyptians hunted with boomerangs. But if you go also down to museums like the Mexico City Museum for the Aztecs and Zapotecs and Toltecs, you'll also see boomerangs on display there. And the Hopi Indians, who live here in northern Arizona near the Grand Canyon, they supposedly were the keepers of this secret Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. And the Hopis also hunt with boomerangs, and they were famous for that. Prior to the Spanish conquest, that's what young Hopi warriors did. They went out with boomerangs and hunted birds and rabbits and things like that.
All right, let's talk about the Olmecs if we can. Who were the Olmecs, David?
You know, the Olmecs are a very recent civilization to us. Prior to really 1940, the Olmecs were completely unknown. Up to that time, the archaeologists believe that the oldest civilization that was in Central America was the Mayans. And the Mayans went back to, at that time, they were saying, well, the Mayans went back to, say, 500 BC, 800 BC, something like that. But what happened was, in the 1930s, art experts in the United States began realizing that there was this style of art coming out of Mexico that was totally unique, and it wasn't Mayan, and it wasn't Aztec or Zapotec or Mixtec. It was this very unusual and distinctive kind of art, statues, jade artifacts, things like that. And this is how they found the Olmecs. But, and the look of the Olmecs is very curious. The most famous things of the Olmecs are what we call the colossal heads, these gigantic basalt heads. They weigh 20 tons, and they look like Nigerian rugby players or something. They're wearing helmets. They look very, very African. They have the typical Negroid wide nose and thick lips. If you when you see these guys, they don't look like Mayans. They look extremely African, although some Olmecs also look very Oriental. They look very Chinese. Even other Olmecs have beards and mustaches. They look more like Mediterraneans, Phoenicians, and things like that. So in 1940, what happened was the archaeologists in Mexico had a special conference, and they called archaeologists from all over the world. And at that time, they gave them all this evidence for the Olmecs. They said, yeah, there's this other culture that's older than the Mayans. It's older than every culture that we can find in Central America. And, in fact, this ancient culture that now we're going to call it the Olmecs, the rubber people, they're the ones who, in fact, created the calendar. They created the number system. They created the ball game. Many of the early Mayan cities, like those, like Huachacatán, deep in the Petén jungles of Guatemala, they're saying now that, yeah, that was originally an Olmec city, but eventually became a Mayan city. The Olmecs themselves go back, they're saying, to about 1,500 BC. The Olmecs are characterized by, again, this really unusual facial features. They often have this frown. They look like they're Africans. And they have the cone heads. They have this elongated skulls. Very curious to see. And as you can see, George, in my book, Mystery of the Olmecs, there's a lot of pictures of these guys, and they're really strange looking.
Are they from this planet?
Well, boy, when you see some of these guys, and they're heavy, elongated heads, I mean, for whatever reason, they have either bound the heads as babies, or else they naturally look like this, but their cranial capacity is like double that of a normal human.
Yeah.
And people look like this all over the world. Akhenaten and Nefertiti, Egyptians did this as well. Tutankhamun himself was also what we'd call a cone head, head binding. And the dolicephalus is the technical term for that, where you have an elongated cranium. I have a whole chapter in Mystery of the Olmecs about this, and the more you look into this whole thing of head binding, of shaping these long of cone head craniums, the weirder that gets.
Because I'm not sure that they made these. These look like they're genetic mutations, or they came from someplace else.
When you see them, they look like aliens, and that's been a natural assumption, because when you see some of these skulls and the figurines and things like that come out of Mexico, also South America, yes, you're right. I mean, they look like they're extraterrestrials. I mean, they
look at the size of the eye sockets, David. They're huge.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, these are not the kind of guys you're going to want to meet in a dark alley. They look like something out of, like, these alien movies or something like that. And, in fact, that Swiss artist, Geiger, who created all those, that kind of look of these long-headed, sort of, you know, in sort of insectoid aliens in that movie. But that is what these guys look like. Jeez. And when you show photos of just your typical Olmecs, they're some weird-looking guys. I mean, you can hardly believe it.
Are you familiar with Lloyd Pye's work in The Star Child?
Yes, I am.
And very similar skull.
Well, right, and his skull, and I've been privileged to examine the Star Child skull myself. I've met Lloyd a couple of times, and that is a really unusual skull, and that's the kind of thing we're talking about, and where you have these really strange skulls. Some are smashed sideways, kind of like his Star Child skull is like that, and there are you will see in. Particularly in Mexico and in Peru, you will see in museums some of these skulls, and some are really shocking to see. They're just so bizarre. We don't know why people did that. Now, it may be that some of these people really were extraterrestrials. That's just how they naturally looked. We know that at least in some cases, the Olmecs and the Mayans and people all over the world, in fact, were doing this, including the Kurds in northern Iraq, the Egyptians in Malta, they were doing this. People were somehow, they would shape young babies' skulls like this, at least in some cases. When you are still an infant, you have plates in your head, and they haven't fused yet. They're to allow your head to grow bigger, but eventually, as an adult, the plates in your head do fuse together. Prior to that, you can work with the head, and we know that in some cases people did this.
But Can you make it that large? And what about the eye sockets? How do you make your eye sockets twice as big as a normal human?
Well, that's a good question. With the deformation of these skulls, I mean, it would deform the eye sockets too, and even it would have been a problem in some cases, you would think, for that their heads would have become so heavy, and the back of their heads are extended like twice as far as ours. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you see these weird skulls like this that it would have been even hard for them just to hold their heads up. If you look at statues of Nefertiti, of Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, their daughters, Meretaten and Mekhetaten, they also have these really weird elongated skulls. I mean, maybe they were extraterrestrials too, and that has been suggested, of course. But there are ways. I mean, maybe they were trying to copy these extraterrestrials, or they were...
Right, that's possible.
Right. Some of these people probably were humans.
Or maybe hybrids?
Hybrids, right? And you know, even you know, and I know Zachariah Sitchin too, and I'm familiar with his work. It's quite interesting. I do disagree with him on a number of things, but you know, the idea that these Anunnaki, some aliens, are here, that also that they look like this. You know, they extraterrestrials don't necessarily look a whole lot different than we are, and in fact, perhaps you know, we are extraterrestrials too, in that sense. But with these elongated skulls, this was really a hallmark of the Olmecs. And also this a special frown that they had. There were certain looks. There was a V cleft also in their heads, like they actually had, at least they depicted this kind of a cleft right at the top of their head. They did. The Olmecs did all kinds of weird stuff, including tattooing, piercing. They had Mohawk haircuts. A lot of the weird stuff that we do today, they were doing back then. And it kind of shows you, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. But a lot of these weird Olmec characters, you know, except for the really elongated heads, I mean, they would almost look like a modern guy walking down the streets of Los Angeles or something.
Hey, David, when we come back, let's talk about the kind of technology that they might have had. And also, you know, you've done some work on lost cities. What about Atlantis? I got to talk with you about that, too. We'll be back in a moment. David Hatcher Childress, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. David, can we speculate on what kind of technology the Olmecs had? What do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the strange things that the Olmecs did was carve these giant heads out of basalt, and they weighed 20 tons. The basalt is extremely difficult rock to carve. It's so hard. So you have to look into that. I mean, the whole thing of moving giant megalithic blocks around, the Olmecs did that. Mexico does have megalithic cities, such as Monialban and Mitla, also La Venta, the center of the Olmecs. So you kind of, one of the things that we look at, and say with the Olmecs, with the Egyptians, ancient India, Atlantis, and whatnot, is what ancient people are able to do. And if you are able to take quarry a 100-ton block of granite or basalt, move that 20 miles, stack it up in a giant wall, places like Baalbek, Peru, Mexico, certain Pacific islands, I mean, you're in Egypt, of course. What you're doing is something that even modern construction companies wouldn't do today. It's kind of the way we look at the past. And this was in my book, Technology of the Gods. This was the subject I tackled was, okay, we perceive ancient civilizations as being primitive. The way that modern historians paint the past to us is, well, 8,000 years ago, people were cavemen, very primitive. Then suddenly they just stepped out of their caves, started building ziggurats and pyramids and things like that. And lo and behold, here we are, modern man with all of this cool stuff that we have. But really, the ancient civilizations weren't like that. There's a roller coaster of ups and downs. That's what the graph of history would read. We would have times of enlightenment and science, these golden ages of legends. But then there have been crashes, and that this happened with the Olmecs too, where suddenly these guys are moving giant heads around, they're carving huge statues, then moving giant blocks around. You see this, say, in Peru, and then suddenly it all just stopped. Some cataclysm just halted all the workers. They left huge blocks the size of a semi-truck just lying on roads and things like that. They were never made it to the giant wall or something that they were making. In Technology, the Gods, and in all my books on Lost Cities, what I try and point out is that people would not be building, like the Olmecs, with giant blocks of basalt or granite. I mean, some of these things weigh 100 tons. The giant blocks at Baalbek in Lebanon, these weigh 1,000 tons, 100,000 tons, which would be 200,000 pounds. Even modern cranes wouldn't try and lift and move these blocks, yet ancient people were doing that. And you have to ask the question, why would the Olmecs or the ancient Peruvians or other people on these Pacific islands and stuff, why would they want to go around and build with 100-ton blocks, 20-ton blocks? It seems incredible. They don't have to build like that.
Right.
I mean, we don't do that today. We don't. Construction companies don't go around hauling around 20-ton blocks and stacking them up. Maybe for the Lincoln Monument or the Jefferson Memorial or something like that. So you have to ask yourself, I mean, and this is what, say, Zachariah Sitchin would do, Eric Von Däniken, myself, Graham Hancock, that is, why are they doing this? It's because they've apparently chosen to do something so incredibly hard. Even today, we would find it so difficult with all of our modern equipment. Yet they were trying to do that. It would seem that somehow they were able to do these things easier than us, and that what seems so incredibly difficult was easy for them. I mean, it's like they had to have some kind of anti-gravity, some sort of levitation device that made these stones weightless. This island that I was talking about earlier, Nan Madol, on Ponape Island in Micronesia, The legend of that island, this city, built of 150 million tons of basalt in 100 artificial islands in the ocean. The legends on that island are that those stones flew through the air. And in fact, archaeologists don't even know where they got all of the basalt that they used in this city. It's like entire mountains of basalt would be dismantled to create the city of Nan Madol. And the natives are saying, yeah, the stones flew magically through the air, some kind of a levitation, stacking these things up. When you see the huge walls, like at Ollantaytambo in Peru, Tiwanaku as well in Bolivia, stuff in Egypt and Baalbek, what we're talking about, there's plenty of other places. When you see that, I mean, it only makes sense that they could have somehow made these huge stones weightless. NASA has even done experiments like that of acoustic levitation and stuff like that. Sound waves can make things lose weight. They're constantly doing studies like this. They had to have something like that. In my book, Technology of the Gods, I actually go into a whole chapter about Vimanas, that they had ancient aircraft. When you read the...
That's an incredible story. You talk about that for a little bit, David, okay?
Sure. You know, when you read the ancient Hindu epics, the Mahabharata, part of that is the Ramayana, they read like the wildest science fiction.
They really do, yeah.
And Rama, these ancient Hindu kings and other people, they get into these airships. They're called in Sanskrit Vimanas. In ancient Hindu epics and stuff, they talk about these a lot. Rama, in the story of the Ramayana, this is all supposed to be 10,000 years ago or more. His wife runs away from him. He goes into the Ayodhya forest in northern India, meditates for a while. He's bummed out because his wife's left him. Then after a couple of years, he actually, you know, decides, oh, I'm gonna go get her back. He gets in his Vimana, this aircraft. He flies to Sri Lanka, battles with this Ravana guy who's stolen his wife. He gets her back, takes her back to northern India, all in his Vimana and these airships. Also, in the Mahabharata, they talk about these airships fighting battles. Their horrific wars are fought. Entire cities are just decimated by the weapons in these craft. And then, you know, in fact, an entire book was discovered in ancient India about Vimanas. When you read some modern novel where the hero, James Bond, gets onto a British Airways flight, flies to Switzerland or something, you know, the author's not going to suddenly stop and tell you what an airplane is and describe it and how airplanes work and all that kind of stuff. They know that you know. So all they have to do is just mention an airplane, and you know what they're talking about. And that's how the ancient Indian epics were, too. They talked about these Vimanas, these airships, but they didn't go into great detail about them because they knew that you knew what they were. Finally, in 1908, this ancient book from the 4th century B.C. called the Vimanika Shastra was found in this library in India, and it said that it was a book taken from older books and that it was all about Vimanas. And it talked about different kinds of Vimanas. They were these metal craft. It talked about propulsion. Mercury was part of it. It talked about electricity. There was even stuff about the weapon system and stuff like that in the Vimanika Shastra. There weren't any illustrations, and it was basically an archaic Sanskrit. Then modern Sanskrit scholars were translating it. And it's, in India, this is a popular subject. Every single Hindu or Buddhist in India knows what a Vimana is, knows the stories. They're familiar with that whole story. Now, what happened then? British and Indian and Pakistani archaeologists began excavating these cities out in the Thar Desert between India and Pakistan right after World War II. These were just cities out in the desert, and in fact, they were made out of fine brick. They discovered them because they were looting brick from these cities to build some of the railroads in Pakistan. When the British archaeologists got to the city streets in the late 40s in these excavations in India and Pakistan, people were just lying dead in the streets, just like the ancient Indian epics had said. This doom had taken over cities like Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, Kodigi, and it was, as the ancient Indian epics had talked about, these horrific wars, these cities were devastated. And that's what they discovered. People were just lying dead in the streets. They found these melted glass blobs that turned out to be melted ceramics. Some super heat had also destroyed these cities. It was like kind of like atomic devastation. And in fact, no one came and buried the dead or anything. In the dead people just lying in the streets. Then the desert came in, covered them with sand, and for thousands of years, these cities just sat there until the excavation in the 40s. It's an interesting thing here, too, George, is that
it is fascinating stuff, David.
Well, and what's important about, say, the ancient Indian epics, Vimanas, ancient India itself, throughout history, knowledge and libraries have been destroyed. There have been great libraries in Egypt, in China, also in Mexico, and all over the world. The Library at Alexandria held hundreds of thousands of volumes on history and science and technology and stuff like that. All those books were destroyed in, you know, like the 3rd century A.D. The Emperor Qi Huangqi of China, the same emperor who built the Great Wall and has those the terracotta warriors that are so famous, he ordered every book in China destroyed, like 500 B.C. The Spanish, when they conquered Mexico, they gathered all of the Mayan codexes, the hieroglyph books of the Mayans, and destroyed them all. There's only 4 known Mayan books still in existence. So throughout history, I mean, this is one of the problems with trying to piece together what's happened. History's been purposefully destroyed, where the dictator of the time literally orders all books destroyed so that history will start again with them. India is one of the few countries where there's really still a continual line of knowledge and language going back thousands of years. And this is with the Vimanika Shastra book. Sanskrit scholars today can still read these really ancient books. But that is unique. In ancient Egypt or in China and places like that, I mean, people, they have some early hieroglyphs and scripts, but people cannot read them.
So, you know, Michael Cremo thinks we are hundreds of millions of years old. I'm beginning to think he may be right.
You know, and that's in his books, too, and I know Michael Cremo, and also in my book on technology of the gods. Yeah, you look at some of these unusual artifacts. I mean, there's metal objects, chains, metal balls and things like that. And here in North America, there's been a number of stories like that where it's your typical lump of coal kind of story, and inside of it is a nail or a gold chain or something like that. And, of course, when geologists are saying, well, you know, all this stuff's millions of years old. I mean, that lump of coal is millions of years old. The, some geological formation that they blasted out. Yeah, I mean, and so, I mean, if that's the case, if everything really is, you know, millions and millions of years old, then when they find artifacts that are man-made or artificial in some way, yeah, I mean, that's an indication that mankind or some other race was occupying this planet, yeah, before we got here. There's a strange story too, George, that you might know about, which was in Wyoming in the 1930s. They were blasting out this cliff, and inside a cleft in this cliff was this miniature person, and he was in solid rock. And there's photographs of this guy too, and he's called the San Pedro mummy. He's about 2 feet tall. He was mummified. He was inside this cliff.
Fully developed.
Fully developed, yeah. I mean, there are photographs of this guy, even x-rays. But where, and he's another missing artifact, as a matter of fact, and one where we actually have photos of it, and it was studied briefly, but where that San Pedro, Wyoming mummy is today, no one knows. It just disappeared.
And, again, it's part of the mysteries of the ancients. And we're running out of time. I want to talk with you about Atlantis next hour as we take phone calls. Let's touch again on the possibility of ancient atomic wars. You know, again, the Vedas point out explosions, mushroom clouds. It had to have happened.
Well, I have a whole chapter in Technology of the Gods about ancient atomic warfare. It seems so incredible. I mean, just that the ancients would have machines, that you would have to have electricity, machining tools, power tools. You're going to have aircraft, much like we have today. They apparently had UFO-type craft, actually flying discs, tubular-shaped craft. And the idea then that they fought these horrific wars, this is what the Ramayana and the Mahabharata were talking about. And, I mean, there really is evidence for this. out in the south west part of Egypt is this huge field of glass. This is right where, if you've got a map where Egypt and Libya and Sudan all come together, that area is uninhabited desert. It's just it's the sand dunes and flat sand. In the 1930s, as British archaeologists and geologists went out into that area, and they're driving Land Rovers and stuff just through the desert, what they found was that for miles around in that area, there were just huge sheets of glass. And it wasn't until really the first atomic test at Alamogordo in New Mexico, where they detonated the first atomic bomb during World War II. And that, of course, did exactly the same thing. It turned the desert around Alamogordo to sand, white sands, that area they call it. So there's certain areas of the world that are have also been turned to sand, but it's happened in ancient times. So, I mean, naturally, archaeologists and geologists, I mean, the idea that there was somehow some atomic warfare that, just like today, turned areas of the desert into basically sheets of glass, I mean, that's, they just can't accept that. I mean, that just can't possibly be the answer. So, therefore, they have to search for other answers. In the case of the sheets of glass out in the Egyptian desert, you know, their explanation is that some kind of comet or asteroid came screeching across the Sahara, melted the desert, turned some of this glass, turned the sand into glass, but there's no impact for this comet or asteroid. So it somehow just kind of skimmed along the surface of the earth, turned sand into glass, and then, you know, went back out into outer space or something like that. So you're looking, it's looking at the past in a different way and trying to make sense of the legends, the myths, and the evidence that we can see.
Stay with us, David. We'll take phone calls. We'll talk about Atlantis next hour. Hey, David, before we take calls, let's talk a little bit about Atlantis and the possible connection of Mount Shasta. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating one. I do mention that a little bit in my Lost Cities of North Central America book. I mean, the whole idea, too, of ancient civilizations having some pretty high-tech stuff, including earth-moving equipment, tunneling equipment, airships like we're talking about. Supposedly Atlantis had this stuff too. You know, I talk about in one of my books, Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, how there was a kind of a Tesla system broadcasting power like Nikola Tesla wanted to do. These airships picked up on this power. And so the idea too of going underground, one of my books on that subject is a book called Lost Continents in the Hollow Earth, and it's all about myths and legends and weird stuff, tunneling underground, that kind of a thing. And Mount Shasta fits into that, of course. It's interesting to think of Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, and I'm from Colorado, and Cheyenne Mountain is near Colorado Springs. Everybody in Colorado knows all about it. But here you have what is basically a mountain that's been hollowed out by the U.S. military. Inside that mountain is a city, a military city. It's a secret city in a way. You can't go in there, but, you know, the military admits they have it.
Was it a bunker?
What's that?
Is it a bunker for the Illuminati?
Well, it's kind of one of them. Yeah, I mean, they have a whole bunch of this stuff. And yet, I mean, you have this whole underground world around us. We were talking about the Hopi Indians going underground in the Grand Canyon, living with the ant people and stuff like that. I mean, it's a natural thing. And, in fact, underground buildings, underground bases, whatever, I mean, these are good places to go during cataclysms, during wars, superstorms and stuff like that. Underground, if you had an underground house, it would maintain a pretty constant temperature, winter or summer. So here you have a mountain like Mount Shasta. I mean, the legends of Mount Shasta are very similar in a way to Cheyenne Mountain near Colorado Springs. You have, with Mount Shasta, the idea that it's hollow, there are tunnels and stuff beneath it. Supposedly, Mount Shasta has some kind of Atlantean city in it. Earlier stories, too, it called it a Lemurian city because it was near the Pacific. UFOs are often seen coming and going out of Mount Shasta. I've been told, actually, by people who work for Boeing that that they know certain special things about Mount Shasta, including that the U.S. government has a special radar installations around Mount Shasta to watch the mountain and watch what comes in and out of that mountain. How about
that?
Interesting.
That is fascinating.
Similar things, too, George, are in South America. And I've spent a lot of time in Peru and Bolivia and other countries in South America. I love going down there. In my book, Lost Continents of Hollow Earth, a lot of that is about the Andes and my book on Lost Cities of and Ancient Mysteries of South America. But there, too, around Lake Titicaca, also around Cusco, there's a special lake. And it's, you know, well known in those areas that UFOs are seen coming out of these lakes, also out of Lake Titicaca. So you have also, apparently, and it seems to be around Lake Titicaca, which is, and that is a giant, huge lake that is half in Bolivia, half in Peru. So, like Mount Shasta, you have this idea of hollowed out mountains in the Andes. They are these UFO bases. Some of them also come out of lakes and things like that. The idea there is, and I talk about this in Technology of the Gods and whatnot, my book on Vimana aircraft of ancient Indian Atlantis, that in ancient times, we're talking excess of 10,000 years ago, there was a civilization much like we have today, not a consumer society the way ours is right now with all these different commercials and different brands of products and things like that, but they had electricity. They had high-tech stuff. They were even beyond what we have, moving giant stones and stuff like that. At some point, because of these, and there's a theory here, because of these cataclysms of the Earth, sometimes the Earth is destroyed by water, by fire, by ice. This is what the Mayans and Aztecs and Olmecs said. And during these cataclysms of the Earth, pole shifts, whatever, I mean, it's devastating. Oceans spill out of their basins and giant tidal waves wash over continents. Every volcano in the world erupts. Giant earthquakes, you know, happen on a worldwide scale. At this time, what can happen is the Earth, you know, falls back into a Stone Age. But you know, there was high-tech stuff. A little bit like New Guinea. If you've ever gone to New Guinea, that is a one weird place. I mean, it's kind of like some caveman Neanderthal society. People are running around with stone axes. There's a headhunting society. But yet, in certain, you know, capital cities there, Qantas jets land. It's very high-tech, modern world at the airport. But, you know, the rest of New Guinea is living in the Stone Age. So it could be a similar thing here with Mount Shasta and Atlantis, where you have pockets of high technology. They have electricity, hydroelectric plants and stuff, just like we have today, broadcasting it through towers like Tesla. Tesla himself envisioned all this stuff in the sky. He was some, you know, I believe, like a reincarnated Atlantean who was basically reinventing what they already had 10,000 years ago.
They might have had higher technology than we have today.
Well, I think that they did. And, it was, you know, anti-gravity. It was UFOs. Their craft, like these Vimanas and stuff, some of them did have wings and whatnot, but some of them could, you know, hover like, say, a UFO. But the idea of Mount Shasta here and other areas is that as the world fell apart 10,000 years ago, certain isolated areas, kind of like Edgar Cayce's Hall of Records and things like that, but certain places were where, you know, these Atlanteans went to and maintained in a secret place some kind of technology. It's been said of there's places in Tibet like this. Very remote spots where you could have a secret base inside of a mountain like Mount Shasta, where, you know, you have your generators running, you park your Vimanas, you know, you've got your gold, you're going to have hydroponic and whatever. Even you can go out perhaps to local towns and things like that and buy things. And that was one of the stories about Mount Shasta, as you probably know, is that particularly around in the late 1800s, these kind of mysterious people would show up at shops in Northern California, and they would buy things with gold nuggets and things like that. And it was believed by people they were coming out of Mount Shasta.
Okay, to the phones we go now. Wildcard line, Kathy, you're on the air with us. Hi there, Kathy.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, I'd like to ask David Childress, is that his name?
That's David's name, yep.
Yes, I'd like to ask him what he thinks about the Taklamakan Desert.
Okay, the Taklamakan Desert. Yeah, right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, the Taklamakan Desert is out in western China. I have traveled a little bit in that area, and that, too, has similar legends, like Mount Shasta and also around Lake Titicaca and certain secret places of the Andes. Around the Taklamakan Desert is apparently that area, too, was there was an inland sea there in much of the Gobi Desert. They often say that the Shambhala, this also kind of Mount Shasta type area, which is, but rather in Central Asia, is there a secret place of the masters. That area too is near the Chongtong Highlands and the Kunlun Range of mountains, which is northern Tibet, the sort of north west part of the Tibetan Plateau, which is a big mountain range right there. In ancient Chinese beliefs, that area was the land known as Si Wang Mu, and that's where the immortals lived. And in fact, Lao Tzu, the famous Chinese philosopher who wrote the Tao Te Ching, he and Confucius are the two most important philosophers in ancient China. He was leaving China through the Great Wall in western China, and then a guard noticed who he was, because he was a famous person in China at that time. It was about 500 BC. And he persuaded Lao Tzu to write down the Tao Te Ching, which is, in my mind, one of the greatest books ever written, very simple book of the Tao. But where he was going at that time, and he disappeared. Lao Tzu is not a person who's ever known to have died. There's no grave for him. There's no date of his death. He was on his way out into western China, and this was beyond the Great Wall. Once you went out towards the Taklamakan Desert and the Kunlun Ranges, you were out in total wilderness. But this area of China was where they believed the immortals lived. The goddess Kuan Yin, who also known as Si Wang Mu, they lived in this area. And allegedly, there's a mountain in this area, too, like Mount Shasta, that's this hollowed-out mountain and these so-called masters.
Shangri-La,
like Shangri-La, exactly, okay. Or Shambhala. Shangri-La is a fictional account from American novel, but he's basing that on the Tibetan legend of Shambhala.
Okay, well, I understand the Chinese are trying to find it and to destroy it, just like the Hebrews.
Well, that may well be the case. I mean, if you've ever traveled in Tibet in that area, and I have, huge, huge, vast areas. I mean, there are not roads there either. It's very isolated. And certainly, yeah, the Chinese military does, you know, more or less control that area. But it's a huge, huge, vast area. I mean, imagine if Wyoming and Montana and Idaho didn't have any roads in it, you know. I mean, or like one road that went across it, kind of that whole area. That's kind of what it's like out there. You know, that said, the Chinese would probably like to find these places and probably make some effort. But like Mount Shasta, like in the Andes, other places like this, these Atlanteans or whoever they are who are in these, you know, hollowed-out mountains or something, They have technology to repel, I think, the Chinese, and kind of like cloaking devices or something like that. And you know what? If the Chinese ever got close to their hideouts or something like that, they would probably just move. And that is one of the stories about Mount Shasta, that the attention on Mount Shasta got, you know, so great really in the 1920s and whatnot, that the one of the stories is that came out of, like, Rosicrucians and stuff in California, was that they had moved and moved up to the Yukon and taken their stuff out of Mount Shasta. However, I would say, I mean, there's still a lot of UFO activity around Mount Shasta. So, I mean, it seems like Mount Shasta is an active area.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up with our wild card line, Jerry in Texas. Hello, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm Jerry from Spring, Texas, listening to KTRH on the channel 740. I want to ask David a question there. I think David's his name. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, David, those statues that's on Easter Island, nobody's ever figured out how they got them, how they quarried them, and whatever happened to the people. And then they found out that they weren't just little bitty short statues. They was, some of them was 40, 50, 60 foot deep. The rest of the statue, did the faces kind of go along with those statues you found, those Mexicalis, or where, however you pronounce it?
The Olmecs, yeah, right. You know, I mean, that's a good point. And, in fact,
they had large eyes, and they looked like they had a sink in their forehead where they...
That's right. I mean, they are cone heads, too, what we're talking about. These, yeah, I mean, and that's an interesting point. When you start looking, particularly when you look at Olmec statues, statuettes, I mean, they really clearly have these long, gated heads. I mean, and they're quite narrow. I mean, they look like these weird cone heads. It's quite odd. Those statues on Easter Island are also these cone heads, these people with elongated skulls. And those the Easter Island statues are so very unusual, and they have very long ears, too. There's another distinctive feature there, where their earlobes and their ears are very long. The Incas also supposedly had these very long earlobes. And that's also a Buddhist thing. If you ever see depictions of Buddha, he also has very, very long ears and stretched-out ears. On Easter Island, I mean, they talk about a war that happened there in prehistory, and it was a war between the long ears and the short ears. Yeah, those statues are pretty strange, and many of them, too, just buried up to their chests in volcanic ash, and you would think that would take a long time just to have all this detritus. The islanders claim, like Etna Madal, at this island in Micronesia, where the islanders say that the stones flew through the air, on Easter Island, the legend there is that those statues walked. And those statues walked everywhere they are, and they're in various places around the island. And in fact, I mean, the islanders also say that a power came out of their eyes. They put certain statues around the edge of the island, facing inland. And they had eyes that were inlaid in the statues. And according to the islanders, this power that they call mana, some kind of occult power, came out of their eyes, the eyes of these statues, and it was to protect the island, to keep it from sinking, because they believed that their island was part of this Pacific continent. They called it Hiva, H-I-V-A, Hiva. And Easter Island was the last little bit of this ancient continent, and the statues were there to keep it from sinking under the Pacific Ocean, too, like the rest of this continent.
What if they were robots? The statues robots? Is that possible?
Well, it's more like they were able to levitate the statues. The statues do not have feet, okay? They're basically from right around the waist up. And their hands come down, and their hands are sort of folded, typically, in front of their belly. But that's how there's no legs or feet on the statues. But they're still huge, often 40, 60 feet high. I mean, some are gigantic. And some of the largest ones are still in the quarry, and they were never actually completed and removed from the quarry. But just exactly how you're going to, you know, remove one of these giant statues, you got to stand it up, and then, you know, it supposedly moves around the island. And some of the statues were supposedly up on cliffs and things like that, too. So there's, I mean, their legend is basically that, yeah, they like levitated these statues and then moved them around the island to certain places. That's what they're saying.
All right. Hey, David, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls. All of David's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and I'll tell you, he is a true explorer, just absolutely remarkable. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well, and we'll be back in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. David, do you think the ancients from this planet went to the moon before we got there in 69?
Yes, I do, actually, and I talk about that in my book, Extraterrestrial Archaeology, and there's a new DVD out about that, too. You know, according to the ancient Indian epics, what we were talking about before, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and whatnot, they say there that, yeah, they also went to the moon and... Atlanteans, you know, allegedly have been there. I mean, you know, it would be natural, in fact. I mean, if there have been civilizations, advanced civilizations before our own, say 10, 15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, and if they had space flight, aerospace, these aircraft, in theory, yeah, just like us, we were able to make it to the moon, so they could do that too. I maintain in my books Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods, also the Technology of the Gods, and my book Extraterrestrial Archaeology, that on the moon are pyramids, dome structures, and obelisks, and that those obelisks on the moon are identical, basically, to obelisks on Earth. Today, obelisks are really only seen in two countries, in Egypt and in Ethiopia. But other areas had obelisks, too. And, I mean, there's evidence that obelisks were once completely around the world, including at Tiwanaku in Bolivia. There was an obelisk there, supposedly. There was allegedly an obelisk actually in Lake Ontario. And I talk about that in my DVD, how this... Back in the 1800s, there's this park and it was on the Canadian side, and people would go out in the early 1800s to this. They would row out into Lake Ontario near the Canadian side of the border, and there's a park right there. And this obelisk was just barely coming out of the water, and people would actually tie their rowboats up and have picnics and stuff there. And they could see down into the clear, you know, waters of Lake Ontario. They could see this obelisk sticking up. There was a big storm then in 1805. And after this big storm, that obelisk, they would go out there and they didn't find it anymore. It apparently fell over. So, but I mean, incredibly, George, yeah, they're obelisks on the moon. They're called the Blair Cuspids. The Russians particularly have been interested in this. And a lot of the stuff about obelisks on the moon, there's certain grid patterns. There's a lot of stuff on the moon, and I know that you've talked about that, you know, over and over again on the radio. But, yes, I mean, what? So if there are artificial structures on the moon, then, I mean, it's natural to think, yeah, I mean, it's extraterrestrials, it's aliens. And again, maybe we're extraterrestrials and aliens, but yeah, the idea that Atlanteans, guys from ancient India and stuff like that went to the moon, did stuff. There's an interesting video on YouTube that you can see that I've watched a couple of times, and it is apparently, I mean, it seems real. You gotta wonder, but it seems to be the early astronauts from the Apollo moon missions, and they're walking through this crashed spaceship on the moon. I don't know if you've ever seen
really?
It.
Really? No. What's that called? I want to track that
man,
down.
Man, it's worth seeing. I can't remember the name of it, but go onto YouTube and look for videos of the moon. But they're apparently astronauts are going through this crashed spaceship. It's a little bit like that alien movie.
How did whoever put it up on YouTube, how did they get it?
You know, there's been a lot of videos from NASA that have been allegedly suppressed, and people find them. In fact, you can't even believe some of the stuff NASA tells you, how every once in a while it comes out in the news that they've actually lost, like, original footage of them on the moon and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Oh, no, that's
yeah.
That's true.
I mean,
that's
how bizarre true. Is that? You know, it's so it when you see these sort of, you know, weird videos like on YouTube that apparently show the Apollo astronauts doing something completely else, stuff that they don't admit to, and you watch it and you go, wow, that's pretty strange. I mean, either someone is, you know, elaborately faking this NASA video, or else it's real. But it's, yeah, I mean, you know, you find out, too, that within NASA and other areas like that, there are these whistleblowers. There are people who are working
Absolutely.
In these black budget projects and things. I mean, similar to Area 51 or something like that. And every once in a while, somebody comes out, they leak information.
They want us to know.
They do, yeah. People within who are on the inside, they've signed top secret security clearances. They'll go to a military prison if they blab too much, but they're trying to leak this information. Your radio show is part of that, I guess.
To the phones we go again. Let's go to East of the Rockies. Hi, David. You're on the air with us.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Is this George?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. This is a super show tonight. Unbelievable. The only reason I called, I grew up in the southern Illinois area. They call it Little Egypt. Down by Cairo.
Know it well.
Oh, great. Well, in that area, I'm 57 myself. I've all my life heard stories of Egyptian artifacts and finds of different things, scratchings on tablets or rocks. And I just wondered, I never believed it. Never until I listened to this tonight. Now I'm starting to change. Maybe that's possible. Does this gentleman know anything about that?
Well, that is true. David, as you know, Glenn Kimball is very involved in that. But I'll let you elaborate if you know anything about it.
You know, I don't know about Glenn Kimball. I'm sure I'd be very interested in it. But
you'd like to meet him. He's pretty
good.
Yeah,
no, it sounds like it. And, you know, I also live part of the time in Illinois, although I'm not from Illinois, but... Yeah, very much. The whole area of southern Illinois, Tennessee, Missouri, all that area called Little Egypt, all the pyramids and things like that, they've named it those things, and it's there's absolutely something to that. You know, I mean, if you want to see the ancient highways, you know, of the old world, it's look at the river systems. You know, as that's where big cities were then and still today. Where major rivers come together, where rivers meet the ocean, all that kind of stuff. And so, naturally, you know, the Mississippi and Missouri River system is huge. All through that area in ancient times were giant pyramids, pyramid cities, Cahokia and all the many mounds, all through that area. Spiro Mound in Oklahoma, Missouri is just covered with pyramids and mounds. And one of the stories that comes out of southern Illinois, too, is the famous Burroughs Cave story. And that is a story of exactly what we're talking about. Egyptian artifacts found in a cave near the Illinois-Indiana border. I mentioned it and have part of a chapter in my book on lost cities in North and Central America. There's other books that are written about Burroughs Cave. And... there's something to it. The whole idea of Egyptians and other people coming to North America, which they called Turtle Island. If you look at how North America looks with Florida and Baja and stuff like that, it looks like a big turtle, actually, from space, anyway. And, that the Egyptians were there. Again, the whole boomerang thing. People traveled all over the world. The Egyptians especially were very clever. They had giant boats, by the way, and in fact, right near the Great Pyramid in Egypt, they dug up a huge, huge boat. I mean, it was put there as some kind of monument or something by the ancient Egyptians, and it's gigantic. Those boats were made out of planks of wood that were sewn together. And they're huge ships, too. And what's interesting about those ships is that even though they were quite large ships and could carry hundreds of people, they could be completely dismantled and carried, you know, as just pieces, sort as a portage, as we call it today, as portaging canoes and stuff from one river to another around the Great Lakes. That was a very normal thing. But the Egyptians could do that, too. So on their explorations around the world, not only could these ships navigate, you know, huge oceans, but if they were going up a river or something like that and they came to waterfalls or rapids where their ship couldn't go, they could actually completely dismantle this very large ship and then carry it, you know, to wherever they could put it back in the water. And then they would assemble it again and go back in. There seems little doubt, really, in my mind, that the Egyptians and many, many Mediterranean cultures and others came to America, settled. Even they talk about the Welsh coming. The whole idea of Columbus, you know, discovering America is a crazy theory, really. And it's almost like just about every other culture in the world probably also came to America. This is the thing about the Olmecs, too, that's interesting. When you look at the Olmecs in southern Mexico, and this is 3,000 years ago, you see every racial type that exists, from very, very Chinese, Oriental-looking guys to very African-looking guys to people who look like American Indians and others that look very Caucasian with big, thick beards and mustaches. So the Olmec world was a lot like America is, this melting pot of people from all over the planet coming, and, you know, today they're Americans. In the Olmec world, all these different people were the Olmecs. That area, too, of southern Mexico is unusual because that is the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. That's an area where the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean come very close together. This is near Oaxaca and Monte Albán, areas like that. When they were going to make the first Panama Canal, they had three different places they were going to do it. One was in Panama, the other was in Nicaragua, and the third area was this area of southern Mexico where they thought they would make a canal across the entire continent. What the Mexicans did instead of actually building a canal, they just put a railroad across that area. But that's also the area of the Olmecs. So you have this, it seems like the Olmec area was this very international, cosmopolitan area where people from the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean all met, and this was the area of the Olmecs. Similarly, in the lower Mississippi area, where all the rivers come together, they were sun worshipers. They had also, throughout North America, people don't realize this, but as far as north as Wisconsin and Michigan, there were Pyramid of the Sun and a big plaza and a Pyramid of the Moon, just like down in Mexico.
All right, let's go back to some final calls. Wildcard line. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Heidi, go ahead.
Hey, this is Rob from New London. I was wondering if either of you had heard of Gungiwamp, G-U-N-G-Y-W-A-M-P. It's in southeastern Connecticut.
Yes, right. I've heard of the Gungiwamp, and I've been around that area. I need to make more trips into that area, and I've been to America's Stonehenge there in New Hampshire, which is nearby. Yeah, the Gungiwamp area is very interesting, and what she's talking about there, George, is if you don't know about it, it's
no,
Connecticut. It's an area of weird megaliths, dolmens, underground beehive buildings, and things like that. Oddball stuff, and made out of big stones, and it's quite unusual. America's Stonehenge is also even a larger complex with standing stones and things like that. And it's an unusual, weird place, and mainstream archaeologists just totally ignore it. I mean, they just don't want to even talk about it. Other dolmens and other weird sites that are up in New England like that, Canada as well, mainstream archaeologists, just their line on that, America's Stonehenge too, is that, well, you know, these aren't really ancient, just exotic farmers, you know, eccentric farmers who had nothing else to do just suddenly made all this weird stuff, including dragging giant stones around and stacking them up for no real reason, apparently. And that's the Gungiwamp area. So, you know, all through America, I mean, our country, is tons of unusual, interesting stuff, from pyramids to standing stones to, you know, just deserted cities out in the desert. And I don't know who built those things.
Okay, let's go back to the wild card line. Go ahead, Alice. It's your turn.
This is Alice, and I'm calling from Rolla, North Dakota.
Okay.
KFYR radio. David, hi. Hi, George.
Hi.
What I was wondering is, do you know who Mary Summer Rain is?
Oh, I think I might have heard of that
name.
No, I don't really know who that is.
She has a book out that back in 96, 97, and she studied under a Chippewa medicine woman called No Eyes. And she wrote a book, but she wrote it in fiction because she was fearful for her life. And she, in her book, talks all about this underground city with Egyptian artifacts and everything, with tombs and all that.
Okay, that's interesting. Is it? Where is that underground city? Is it in the Grand Canyon?
Yep. Yep.
Hmm.
All right, that's interesting. Well,
And I was wondering, being that you... have you got actual proof? Has Hawass from Egypt, he was here a few months back, is he aware of that? Have they tried to get any of the artifacts?
You know, we don't. The artifacts are completely missing. They're just not to be seen. Zahi Hawass, I would say, I mean, I have met him a couple of times. I don't know him well, but what I know of him, he would not believe that the Egyptians came here. That's not part of his beliefs. He's in a tough situation because, I mean, what's happened really with Egyptology is that Egyptology was really a very European science coming out of the late 1800s, and almost everything that they talk about ancient Egypt today is theories and early archaeological stuff. I mean, that's over 100 years old. You know, this is what the Egyptians did, this is how they did it, blah, blah, blah. Well, the problem with, say, Zahi Hawass and modern Egyptian Egyptologists is that just as Egypt itself is creating its own army of Egyptologists and experts and archaeologists, and, you know, and they've been trained and at Oxford and Harvard and in Paris and Germany and whatever. But just as those guys all become, you know, Egypt finally has its own Egyptologists, because all the experts on Egyptology before weren't Egyptians. They were British guys, French guys, German guys, American guys, Polish guys. Now, finally, Egypt has its own Egyptologists. But you know what? Egyptology has completely changed now.
It sure has. Hey, David, we're out of time, my friend, but I want to thank you. And you stayed away way too long, okay?
It's been great being on your show again, George. Have me back sometime.
You got it. For Kara Scoburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Tim Banal, Lex Lonehood, Lisa Lyon, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.